It's the Burt Cohen Show. Dream can certainly be imperiled by the things that may seem to be out of our control, things like the weather, things like environmental damage, things like global warming and greenhouse gases. We have children, we have a future, we have a country here. What are we doing about climate change? The president has talked about a new serious focus on addressing greenhouse gases and correcting climate change and perhaps doing something about the weather. What is really going on in Washington? There's all kinds of different points of view and places from which legislators are coming, some for doing something, some against doing anything. Those, of course, tend to be the Republicans. But leading the charge to do something for real on addressing climate change is Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders. And I'm very pleased to have with us today, well, not Senator Sanders. He's a tad busy, I'm sure. But Darren Springer, who is Senator Sanders' chief counsel. Darren, thanks so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Darren Springer is the senior aide to the senator on issues before the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee and the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Well, if you would please tell us about Senator Sanders and Senator Barbara Boxer's legislation on climate change. In what ways could it help business, possibly create jobs, and even save billions of dollars, which is now spent on disaster relief?
That's exactly right. The bill is called the Climate Protection Act, and it's Senator Sanders and Senator Boxer. And quite simply, it aims to address the climate crisis, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and create jobs as we move to energy efficiency and sustainable energy technologies. So the elements of the bill are a price on carbon pollution from the biggest fossil fuel polluters, and then a rebate so that families are able to adjust if those companies jack up their prices, make sure that we can help low- and middle-income families in America pay their energy bills, and then significant investments in things like weatherizing 1 million homes a year, which the president had called for in 2008, putting a lot of money into breakthrough energy research and development, creating public-private partnerships so that we can invest in solar and wind and geothermal and biomass and energy-efficient technologies, and a whole host of other investments to make sure that we grow the clean energy economy, cut fossil fuel use, cut emissions, and make America the leader in the world in addressing this crisis.
Well, all this in a time of sequester and a great deal of pressure to cut spending. How much money would this cost? What would the investment be? And I will say that, you know, you often hear the line, well, government should run more like a business. Well, any business I know has to invest prudently to have a prosperous future. So how much money would this be? And is now a good time to be doing that, given all the pressure to cut the deficit?
It's actually, in some ways, it's the perfect time, because what this bill would do is raise revenue. So the carbon fee on the biggest polluters, plus ending some of the fossil fuel subsidies that exist today, something like $10 or $11 billion a year in fossil fuel subsidies that we can end, that the federal government doesn't need to be subsidizing a really mature and profitable industry. So you do those two things, and you raise a significant amount of revenue, and you have enough revenue to provide the rebate to families, to make the investments in energy and infrastructure and growing the economy in a clean way, and also put about $300 billion towards deficit reduction over a 10-year period. So in many ways, this is kind of a win-win-win proposal when you're looking at a difficult budget situation and also the need to clearly reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
And, of course, not everybody is convinced on the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But I think at this point in time, in 2013, we should take it as a given that greenhouse gas and climate change is real, something has to be done about it. What about this carbon tax? That's been, talked about for a while. There's no question that, very few questions, that carbon is a big part of the problem. Carbon emissions, huge amounts of carbon are emitted into the atmosphere every day. But if there's some sort of a carbon tax, might not this put American manufacturers at a disadvantage with big exporters like China, which obviously doesn't have the same standards and probably doesn't even care one bit about carbon emissions?
No, it's an excellent question and something that the legislation seeks to address in several different ways. The first is a provision called a border tariff that would ensure that if a country like China or another country is sending products or fuels into America, that they're going to pay the same type of fee that our domestic manufacturers would pay. So a product coming in from China, we're going to look at the carbon intensity of that product and assess a fee right at the point of importation so that there's no unfair advantage for countries that aren't doing something to reduce their own emissions. Now, looking at something like the European Union, they've had a big effort on climate change. We might have a reciprocal situation where we wouldn't charge those countries a fee if they had a substantially similar program to the program we have. But above and beyond that, the bill sets aside $75 billion to help manufacturers invest in energy efficiency, helping to save energy, make them more competitive, and then also $10 billion over 10 years in job training so that we can help create the workforce to take on the new jobs in solar and wind and other technologies. And then finally, the legislative package also includes a five-year extension of a clean energy manufacturing tax credit that was part of the federal recovery package a few years ago but has since expired. And that would provide a company looking to invest in manufacturing of clean energy technologies a 30% tax credit to invest in America. So there's a number of elements of the package seek to address that issue of trade.
Well, we are talking with Darren Springer, who is chief counsel and senior aide to Senator from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent. And he's working with Senator Barbara Boxer of California. What about the resistance that has come up from the good old Republicans saying you're picking winners? Should the government be in the business of picking winners?
Yeah, and I guess the response to that is really that the government has been picking winners for a very long time when it comes to energy.
Right.
Some of the tax incentives for the oil companies have been on the books for 100 years now. The nuclear industry gets a huge sum of subsidies, including Price-Anderson, which basically provides federal liability insurance for nuclear reactors. It's been in place since 1957. It was extended through 2025 just recently. So all these other mature industries have all of these built-in subsidies. And then when we go to extend a credit like the production tax credit for wind or the investment tax credit for solar, then you start to hear some of that conversation about winners and losers. So I think the frame of reference that we're looking at here and that Senator Sanders has used is if the government's going to be investing in energy, which clearly it is, let's invest in the technologies that are safe, the technologies that are new and emerging and that can actually reduce pollution, reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and let's stop subsidizing technologies like nuclear and fossil fuels, which have been around for half a century, a century or more, and probably should be able to stand on their own two feet at this point.
And I'm certainly pleased to hear you mention Price-Anderson. Not enough people are aware of the power of the Price-Anderson Act, as you said, from 1957, which makes it so that nuclear power doesn't have to face the open market and buy insurance like any other business. Because if it weren't for the Price-Anderson Act subsidizing nuclear power, if they had to go out and find insurance on their own, I seriously doubt there would be nuclear power in this country, which is tremendously capital intensive and costly, and really many people, including myself, think should not be part of the all of the above approach. So one of the things about Washington that even a casual observer is aware, there's some powerful lobbies there. It's almost like the image seems to be that there's the lobbyists in the real power and various different members of Congress and senators, you know, when the lobbyists say jump, they just ask how high. Is there a lobby working for the Sanders and Boxer legislation? Is there the horsepower there that could make it happen?
Well, the lobby that we have is the grassroots, the environmental organizations, the pro-consumer organizations. So we've had folks from 350.org and Bill McKibben and the Sierra Club and their executive director, Mike Bruhn, come and support the legislation. We've also worked with Public Citizen, which is a public interest and pro-consumer group that understands that this is the kind of legislation that we need, and also groups that are doing work in communities like the National Community Action Foundation, National Association of State Community Services Programs. These are folks all around the country that are helping weatherize homes, provide services in the communities. They're supportive of this legislation. But, you know, clearly you're right. The lobbyists for the oil companies, the American Petroleum Institute, have already said that, you know, they want to see this bill dead. They don't want to see it come to the floor of the Senate. Certainly, I think their friends in the coal industry would agree as well.
Sure.
And so what we've got to do is really get the word out all around the country at the grassroots level that, you know, Congress just appropriated $60 billion to pay for the damage from Hurricane Sandy, and appropriately so. And then the year before, in Vermont and elsewhere, a lot of folks recovering from Hurricane Irene. And
that's
so
terrible.
The federal government's paying for the disasters, but we're not paying to actually invest in mitigating the crisis. And I think if we can get that message out, that people will rally around a solution like this.
And again, well, you're talking to the grassroots here on the Burt Cohen Show. We reach exactly that market audience, I hope, and certainly we don't have anywhere near the power of the oil and coal industry. But I think you're right, Darren Springer of Senator Sanders' office, that this is where the change is happening. And President Roosevelt talked about being for various different issues, but needing people out on the streets to make it happen. And this needs to be made happen by the people making noise. How does it look in the Senate right now? It's a tough field there. They have all those rules with regard to filibuster numbers and things like that. What are the chances? Where is the bill right now? Has it been heard in committee yet? Or tell us about the status in the U.S. Senate.
So we're very early in the process, and
that's
where
good.
We are is, you know, the bill has been introduced and it's been sent to the Environment and Public Works Committee, where Barbara Boxer is the chairman and Bernie Sanders is on the committee. So you
That's
have two
good.
Senators there who are going to work to have hearings in the committee and bring in some of the top experts, climate scientists, business leaders, environmental leaders, and others to look at the bill and certainly, you know, improve it and try to pass it out of committee. That's what Chairman Boxer had said was her commitment. To look at in the spring, summertime, to have hearings and try to pass the bill out of committee and get it to the Senate floor. And, you know, certainly it's an uphill battle politically. You have the filibuster issue in the Senate, and then you have a House that's not at all been responsive to the climate crisis or wanting to take any kind of positive action on sustainable energy. But the one thing I would mention is the president was certainly clear in the State of the Union that he intends to use the authority he has with the EPA, with the Clean Air Act, to crack down on carbon emissions if Congress doesn't take action. So, you know, this legislative solution would be a very good solution. And if we can't do something like this, certainly the president has tools at his disposal to begin to make more progress. Already we've got good fuel economy standards for vehicles. The Recovery Act invested heavily in clean energy, but there's a lot more to do, and there's a lot more we can do with the Clean Air Act in particular.
Do you have any support from Republicans in either the Senate or the House? You know, they talk, some of them must care about jobs, I would think, and rebuilding our economy. And what better way to rebuild our economy than, you know, create jobs, weatherizing and retrofitting, creating new, cleaner technology? What's your sense? Is there any Republican support? Or I would hope that certainly as great and, you know, powerful in the Senate as Sanders and Boxer are, you need some allies as well. How does it look?
No, that's right. And unfortunately, in the current political environment, there's not a whole lot of Republican support for a comprehensive solution like this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are some members on the Republican side who you know, do not acknowledge the science of climate change.
Right.
Some who believe that it's a hoax. So you lose a chunk of folks right there. And then of those who accept the science, there are certainly differences on what the solution should be. So having said that, what we do have is this is a broad legislative package. There are a number of pieces here that may have bipartisan support. There's been bipartisan support in the past for funding weatherization.
Oh.
There's been, you know, support for different steps to do things like a public-private partnership to invest in sustainable energy technology. So, you know, Senator Sanders, Senator Boxer are certainly going to be as, you know, strong as they can trying to move the entire package and also looking for ways to figure out which pieces can
right.
move individually. How do we work with different members on different issues, because, you know, we want to make progress anywhere we can.
Sure.
Any of these pieces we can move.
And what is your sense of any support from the White House? I know it's early on, which is a good thing in terms of building the essential grassroots support. But, you know, Obama has said some really good things about the environment. What's your sense of how they may come down on this? Or is it too early for discussions with the White House on this?
Well, certainly they've had some very positive remarks about needing to do something strong on climate change. I think that this particular type of legislative solution, a carbon fee, a direct carbon
right,
fee,
right.
has not been something that they've been supportive of. I think the press secretary, Jay Carney, and the new Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, have both said publicly that the White House is not proposing or supporting a carbon fee. Given that, I don't know if they would support that part of the bill. There may be other things in the bill that they would like, but the president has certainly called on Congress to act, and Senator Sanders, Senator Boxer are the first to the plate here with a solution. There may be other bills that come out. It'd be great to have you know, more momentum on this, more members engaged on it, more legislation. But ultimately, either Congress has to pass something and send it to the president's desk, or the president's going to have to use that authority that he has under the Clean Air Act to really reduce carbon emissions at power plants and you know, continue to make progress on fuel economy with vehicles.
Yeah, carbon emissions, really, they have to be addressed. And the science has been there for a very long time. And maybe it seems the people are catching up, and perhaps the leaders will follow the people at some point as well. And I want to ask about two new appointments that President Obama has announced. Ernest Moniz has been appointed Energy Secretary, and Gina McCarthy has been appointed to head the EPA. Of course, they need to go before the Senate. But how do you think they will react to Senator Sanders and Boxer's initiative on this?
Well, it's very, very early in the process in terms of their nominations. We haven't had hearings or an opportunity to talk with them about this, but certainly Senator Sanders will be talking with both of them about this legislation and the broader set of priorities. And I think, you know, he's certainly looking for strong nominees in those positions who understand the planetary crisis of global warming and want to use all the tools that they have to move as aggressively as possible. And I, you know, you mentioned the climate science, and I would just add that, you know, even in the last few weeks, we've had briefings in the Senate Environment Committee from some of the leading scientists who have said that, you know, some of their predictions a few years ago may have been conservative, and that, you know, if we don't do anything, if we continue with business as usual, by the end of this century, you could see 8 degrees, perhaps 10 degrees, maybe even more Fahrenheit of warming, and that would be just catastrophic.
Yes.
I mean, we talk about the economy. If you know, you don't have an economy if sea levels are rising and swamping coastal communities, and if there's extreme heat, drought, and extreme weather destroying agriculture, destroying our infrastructure. So they've laid out a really dire scenario that if we don't take action, we're going to see some severe consequences, you know, in the lifetime of our children and grandchildren, and certainly we're seeing some of those consequences now. So you know, the senator is going to look to support nominees who can help us deal with the crisis and try to you know, move legislation like this or pieces like this, but also use the tools they have at the executive level,
and
anything we can do.
What do you know about these two appointees? How is the environmental community reacting to these new appointees to head the Energy Department and the EPA?
Well, again, it's real early, but, you know, we've had an opportunity to work with Gina McCarthy, who's currently at the EPA and is an assistant administrator, and we've certainly worked with Lisa Jackson, who's the outgoing administrator, and the EPA has been, you know, very strong taking action to, you know, not only to deal with carbon pollution, which they're in the process of doing, but also cracking down on mercury, which is, you know, quite simply a toxin. You know, that can cause brain damage and other, you know, major health ailments. So they cut down from mercury emissions from power plants. They've tried to cut down on other air pollution. They've tried to, you know, be aggressive using the tools they have. So, you know, Gina McCarthy has been a part of that process, and the EPA has had a pretty good record to this point under President Obama. The Secretary of Energy is a very important position. There are a whole lot of investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency in particular that take place at the Department of Energy, a lot of important research and development. I don't know, Dr. Moniz, I don't know that we've had a chance to have him in here, so we'll certainly have, you know, questions for him about, you know, his views. The senator will want to know where he stands on some of these key questions, but his background is substantial, and Secretary Chu has, you know, particularly with the Recovery Act, administered some of the most significant and historic investments in energy and clean energy that we've ever seen. So those are big shoes to fill, and we'll be looking to work with the next secretary as well.
Again, our guest today on the first half of the Burt Cohen Show is Darren Springer, chief counsel to Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont. And we're talking about a piece of legislation to really help address climate change and look at reducing carbon. What are you going to do when the opposition says the word Solyndra?
I'm glad you raised this, Bert, because Solyndra...
You know they're going to.
Yeah, and Solyndra is probably one of the most, you know, phony scandals that right. has ever been manufactured. It's not that the company itself didn't you know, fail. They failed, and that has to be acknowledged, but the idea that somehow Solyndra means that sustainable energy generally is not succeeding or that we shouldn't be investing in it is just false. And I'd cite right. a couple statistics just briefly for you.
Sure.
In 2008, when President Obama, you know, was running for election, we had something like 1,500 megawatts of solar electric capacity in this country. And we have increased that dramatically. Thanks to the Recovery Act and other efforts, we're well over 5,000 megawatts today. You look at wind energy, we had 25,000 megawatts of wind energy in 2008. We're over 60,000 megawatts today. So you're talking about dramatic progress just with those two technologies, doubling the amount of electricity we're generating from solar and wind in the last 4 years. So, of course, there are bumps along the road. There are companies like Solyndra that made a bet on a technology that didn't pan out. And, you know, you can raise legitimate questions about their decisions, but more broadly, sustainable energy is booming in America, and if the government could simply provide some limited incentive support and some certainty to those industries and maybe stop investing so much in the fossil fuel and nuclear industries, we could be the global leader. We can overtake China in terms of wind energy. We could overtake Germany in terms of solar energy. We could be manufacturing those products and exporting them and be leaders in the energy technologies of the future.
And we certainly know that there's a lot of people looking for work. It could happen. It could enthusiastically happen. It would be, I think, clearly tremendously good for America, for American business, for our economy, especially for employment. What's the number of the bill? Is there a number assigned to it yet so that people can keep track of it?
There certainly is. It's S. 332, the Climate Protection Act,
S-332. And before I let you go, what's your read of what the heck Obama's going to do on the awful Keystone XL pipeline? Do you have any sense of that? Can you put our hearts at ease here?
Oh, I'm afraid I can't do that because we really don't know what the president's decision is going to be. There was an environmental review released by the State Department on Friday, yes. And frankly, that review really discounted the carbon contribution that Keystone XL pipeline is going to make to global warming, and tried to, if you read that review, it really seems to grease the skids for approval of the project. And, you know, that project is not only bringing a whole bunch of new oil into the marketplace, oil that we don't necessarily need because we are reducing our consumption of oil. We're producing more oil in America, so we don't need that oil. But in addition, the emissions from tar sands are so much larger than conventional oil that one pipeline every year would be just the additional emissions comparing conventional oil to tar sands would be like adding 7 new coal plants worth of emissions just from that one pipeline. And there's a whole lot more from the tar sands that they want to send out. So if we're serious about global warming, cutting emissions, we can't have a project like Keystone XL go forward.
No, we certainly can't. And if we're serious about trying to slow things down like Superstorm Sandy that cost taxpayers $60 billion, we had to, of course, help these people in New York and New Jersey. But I can't help but think that Senator Sanders recognizes that there's a relationship between increasingly frequent natural disasters caused by extreme weather and global warming.
He certainly understands that and makes that point often, and you're absolutely right.
We got to do it. The bill is S-332. The prime sponsors, Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Barbara Boxer, will be watching it. Darren Springer of Senator Sanders' chief counsel, thank you so much for being informative and giving us some degree of hope that if people get behind this thing, we can make it happen and do something about all this weather, etc. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bert, for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
All right, and we'll be back right after this break, which talks about the weather a little bit. Weather certainly is variable by many different inputs on it. It can really change the weather. And as Senator Sanders, Senator Boxer are trying to do something about humans' effect on the weather, we're going to change gears pretty dramatically and talk about Israel, the current state of Israel, not the people Israel, of which there are quite a few throughout the world, but there is this chunk of real estate run right now by a right-wing, very militaristic, some would say racist government that not all Jews around the world, not all of the people Israel are comfortable with. And there's something called AIPAC, which has been exceedingly powerful in Washington, in the halls of Congress for many, many years. AIPAC is the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And there's been some pressure on AIPAC to and get Congress to not be so beholden to whatever AIPAC wants for the state of Israel that they always get. March 3rd through 5th was AIPAC's annual policy conference, and people from Code Pink and many other peace groups were there. And I'm very pleased to have with us a spokesperson for Code Pink, Allie McCracken. Thank you for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show. What was the intent of the APAC Annual Policy Conference, and what was Code Pink trying to do there?
Thanks for having me on, Burt. From March 2nd to 5th, as you mentioned, APAC had its annual policy conference, and every year they bring together thousands of people to our nation's capital, and this year they had around 13,000, where those people go to workshops and they listen to speakers talk about the special relationship between Israel and the United States and their perceived need for continued U.S. military aid to Israel, which stands right now at $3.1 billion every year. And they talk about the threat of Iran and Iran's nuclear program. And they also sometimes, and not so much this year, they talk about how to deal with what a lot of them refer to as the Arab problem. And so Code Pink, Interfaith Peace Builders, and the U.S. campaigns and the Israeli occupation, along with several other groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, held a counter-conference on March 2nd, which was focused on human rights and pursuing a peaceful and just solution to the Middle East conflict, and in particular the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, with a focus on ending the Israeli occupation of Palestine and ending the $3.1 billion every year that goes to Israel, which enables the occupation. And in conjunction with the conference, we also had a series of creative protests outside of the APAC conference so that they would see our opposition. And every year, you know, APAC actually pays student body government leaders from different campuses around the country to come and attend their policy conference. So this year they had about 2,000 students. And those are the people who are really trying to reach out to the most, because they don't have a vested interest in APAC's agenda, but they get this free ride to Washington, D.C. And so we were out there, and a lot of people came up to us and said, "Hey, you know, why are you protesting? I want to know what I'm going into." And it's those sort of minds that we're trying to win over, and also show that there is a movement building around opposition to APAC's belligerent and dangerous agenda.
And again, we're talking with Allie McCracken of Code Pink about counter demonstrations, a counter rally, counter gathering to APAC in Washington. Now, Monday, March 4th was APAC's lobby day on the Hill. What did the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation do to counter this? What is APAC trying to do when they were, I don't know how many people were swarming on the Hill there, and what did what was done to counter their power over members of Congress on the Hill?
Well, the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation put together a lobby packet for the people who attended our conference to deliver to their representatives, and we made sure that everyone set up meetings with their elected officials way far in advance. We also try to do, in the past, we've done very satirical kind of lobbying. We show up to congressional offices wearing settlement costumes made out of refrigerator boxes and, you know, quote-unquote, settle in their offices and put up a little flag that says mine and move their furniture around and say, you know, now you know what it's like to be occupied. This year, we actually tried our hand at some lobbying, and I think it went well. The public perception around this issue is definitely shifting, especially among young people, and I feel like our elected representatives are feeling that shift. And from what I've been told, because I personally didn't attend the lobby day because I've been organizing around the next move that we've got, but from my colleagues who went to the Senate and the House, they said that they were received much better than they have been in previous years. And the people that they met with, whether they were legislative assistants or committee liaisons, they were much more sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians that we're trying to highlight, and a little bit more open to the possibility of cutting aid to Israel, especially given all the budget cuts that we're seeing now around sequestration and, you know, how much our economy is hurting. Putting military aid to Israel on the chopping block is no longer, to a certain extent, it's taboo, but we've been fighting so hard to make it a possibility. I think that it's not completely out of the question now, and so we're hoping that that's something that will go through when the budget cut measures begin to take place, well, when they are taking place.
Now, certainly, if you look at the entire budget, $3.1 billion, you know, to you and me, sounds like an unbelievable amount of money, but comparatively, it's not that big of a slice of the American budget. And I wonder how important it is to the government of the State of Israel.
Right. Well, it might sound like chump change given the entire federal budget, but think of how many schools we could build with $3.1 billion. You know, we had people at the demonstration with us on March 4th who talked about schools in Philadelphia shutting down. Any of that money could have kept those schools open, and any of it, you know, that money could help our infrastructure, help create green jobs that are sustainable. For Israel, it's essential for them to conduct their military operations and to, you know, perpetuate the occupation of Palestine. Israel isn't a poor nation, though, and that's important to recognize. Israel is the 24th wealthiest nation in the world, in fact, and they have socialized healthcare and education for their population. And so I think that it's not just about the money, but it's also about the military collaboration between the United States and Israel that we really need to take into account. We have joint operations with them all the time, training exercises where we fly over. We've even brought over our police forces to Israel to learn different techniques about, you know, this and that. And it's really, it's very deeply entrenched, and the militarism of both countries is disturbingly compatible. And so that's something we need to dismantle as well as part of our activism.
Yeah, the militarization of our police and the so-called Patriot Act, various different ways of snooping, it's a little bit troubling as well. And I guess that's going on in the State of Israel. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest right now is Ali McCracken of Code Pink, which helped create a presence questioning the strength and direction of AIPAC. And if the American government really wants to be so in lockstep with AIPAC. So outside the AIPAC conference, people gathered to greet the AIPAC goers as they left the convention center at the end of the day. How did that go? Was there meaningful discussion? Did anybody say that you, who question AIPAC, are anti-Semitic?
Yeah, well, that charge, the conflation of criticism of Israel with quote-unquote anti-Semitism is all too rampant when it comes to people defending unconditional support for Israel. That's definitely something we came up against. And that's one of the reasons why collaboration is so important in our peace movement. Code Pink works with groups like the U.S. Campaign and Interfaith Peace Builders, but we also work with a really important and critical organization in this movement called Jewish Voice for Peace.
Yes.
And this weekend, Jewish Voice for Peace actually had an ad put up in the Washington Metro system. They had over 100 of them, and it was pictures of six different Jewish people, and it said, Jewish and proud, and AIPAC does not speak for me. And so that's really a false narrative that we're trying to, you know, deconstruct so that we can have meaningful dialogue in order to achieve a just solution to this issue, and so that we don't need to spend $8.2 million every day funneling weapons to Israel to perpetuate this cycle of occupation. So when we were standing outside of, you know, the AIPAC conference, and then on Monday night, the AIPAC gala, that was on March 4th, it was interesting. It's always an interesting mix. This is my third year doing this, and sometimes, you know, they come up to us and they push us. They spit on us a lot. They kick us. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, and my boss, was elbowed in the face right away as soon as we got there. And the police have been generally good about helping us maintain boundaries and space. And it's unfortunate, but also not surprising, because the policies that AIPAC advocates for are inherently violent. know, war on Iran, continued occupation, continued land theft. And so when the people who belong to AIPAC come out and are violent towards us, it's just a reflection of the militarism that they advocate. So anyways, we try to turn that situation on its head and take a very, serious issue and make it into a celebration of resistance. And one of the ways in which we've done that this year and in previous years is by dancing the Palestinian dubka, which is a traditional form of dance that they do in Gaza, the West Bank, and all Palestinians all over the world. And we blast music and we dance and hold signs. And then we have giant, like I mentioned before, those giant settlement boxes, and we run around and act like settlements, and then have people come in with stop signs and say, chant stop settlements. So it's a little bit of street theater mixed in with cultural expression of resistance. And it's fun for us, and it's very sad. And then sometimes we are we switch over and we become very solemn. We also had a die-in during our protests where people were covered in quote-unquote bloody sheets. And we read out loud the names of people who had been murdered in the latest Israeli assault on Gaza. And a lot of people coming out of AIPAC stopped and listened to that.
Uh-huh.
And it was very surprising for many of them that a lot of the victims were children and not the so-called terrorists, which is the propaganda that they've been fed. So the interactions are mixed. Sometimes violent, sometimes meaningful, sometimes frustrating, sometimes engaging. And I have people that I've kept in touch with from previous AIPAC conferences who go every year but are interested in what we're doing and our perspective for their own benefit.
Oh, that sounds productive, basically. I wonder if how many AIPAC attendees, people who go to the AIPAC events, do understand the impact of the settlements? Do they understand what life is like for the people who are occupied? Or do they largely just gloss over it and feel like, well, they need to do this and to build these settlements to heck with the rights of the people whose land it already is? Do they understand?
Right. Well, it's very difficult to gauge that. There were 13,000 people in the conference that we encountered, in comparison to the overall number, a handful, a large handful. But in my interactions, as I mentioned, have been mixed. Some young people have said to me, you know, I'm against the settlement, but I believe that, you know, defense of Israel, Israel is facing an existential threat from its Arab neighbors. You know, that's, I'm paraphrasing, but that's the gist that I generally get. And there is a spectrum of political opinions inside of AIPAC itself. But what's happening is that we see AIPAC as a political organization is suppressing that kind of those different opinions and really setting the tone and controlling the dialogue on this issue and putting forth the policies that are directly impacting our lawmakers. So it doesn't matter if most people inside of AIPAC, a good chunk of people inside of AIPAC are against the settlements. Ultimately, it's the AIPAC organization that gives congressional offices report cards on how they have voted on Israel. It's those who make the campaign contributions. And it's them, they're the ones who bring our representatives on junkets to Israel itself and control those trips and what they see and what they hear. And so we really need to take the lobby head on and expose it for what it is, and that it is a one that doesn't represent the interests of the American people and is ultimately harming Israel by making it hated throughout the world because of its brutal occupation of the Palestinian land.
Certainly questions can be raised about that. There was the AIPAC, as part of the AIPAC gathering, there was the big gala on Monday night, which many members of Congress attended. What do you know about that? Were there a lot of members of Congress there or just a few? What can you tell us?
Well, there were at least 100 there. That's what AIPAC boasted about on their website. And we stood outside during, we were there an hour and a half before the gala started to greet AIPAC members as they went in. And we saw so many elected officials. We saw lots of senators. We saw Senator Carl Levin. We saw Al Franken, who is supposed to be a progressive
Really?
So, you know, we confronted them in a nice way. You know, we had kind of like the good cop, bad cop thing going on where mm-hmm. we had a team greeting politicians coming in from every, you know, different angle and through each of the doors. And so to say, listen, you know, I just want to talk to you about this. And based on their reaction, we would, you know, either chant to them and say, you know, don't go, like our entire crew, because we had a few hundred people outside with megaphones and signs. We would chant, you know, don't go in, don't go in. But if they were rude to us, like I had a congressperson swear at me, and I didn't know who he was, but he had that, he had the pin on his jacket that indicated he was a representative. And when he swore at me, you know, we all chanted shame. And so it really is shameful, though, no matter what party they hail from, it's shameful to have our representatives who are supposed to be working for us and who are paid by us to be pandering to the Israel lobby and working for Israel and instead of the American people. So we were out there to tell them that, you know, we're holding them accountable, and we will continue to do so through lobbying and through call-in days and email blasts where, you know, we flood their inboxes and through direct action by showing up in their offices and demanding meetings if they won't meet with us, you know, because it's also often that they just send out a staffer who sits there and listens nicely and nods. But we've gotten lucky in a lot of cases where if we show up, then they eventually come out to meet with us.
Well, what about, I mean, Senator Franken, definitely one of the more progressive people, but I wonder about him going there, you know, probably got a free meal out of it and maybe some contributions, and then perhaps having some degree of flexibility afterwards. Does it necessarily mean that if a member of Congress or a senator goes to the AIPAC gala, that he or she completely supports their agenda? I wonder about that.
Well, I mean, that's a good question.
I'm sure they could be worked on.
You know,
and what about if don't you get accused of being perhaps naive? I mean, Ahmadinejad of Iran has called for doing away with the state of Israel, and they seem to be interested in. Well, they're certainly interested in nuclear energy, and there's some perhaps legitimate concern that they might be developing really nuclear bombs. What do you say to the charge that you guys are being naive when it comes to Iran?
Well, AIPAC, for starters, was one of the main organizations pushing for us to go to war in Iraq. And we see how that's turned out, and we see how that war was built on lies and, you know, propaganda and creating a hype around something that ultimately ended up not being there.
Right.
And so we're wary when it comes to AIPAC spreading information about Iran's nuclear capabilities and ambitions. And we also see that a military solution has not been viable in Iraq or, you know, basically any other place that we've invaded in the world. And mm-hmm. so we're advocating for an alternative solution, in one in which that includes diplomacy and negotiations, unfortunately for AIPAC. But we also, it seems very clear to us that AIPAC is pushing this hype around Iran to
right.
draw attention away from the occupation of Palestine as it continues to colonize land. And so Code Pink and hundreds of other groups across the entire world are trying to push back against this by participating in the boycott, divestment, sanctions call
mm-hmm.
put forth by Palestinian civil society, which is that in which the international community boycotts Israel culturally, economically, academically, until it complies with international law. So we don't want to get distracted by Israel, you know, crying wolf or, you know, pushing for war or preemptive strike when they are committing their own crimes that we need to hold them accountable for. And also we need to pursue negotiations and diplomacy instead.
Well, certainly history has no lack of outside problems and threats and possibilities of war specifically to divert attention from real problems at home. There's certainly no lack of that in history. Again, we're talking with Ali McCracken of Code Pink about the AIPAC annual policy conference, to which Vice President Joe Biden attended and spoke. And he said, quote, "The preservation of an independent Jewish state is the only certain guarantor of freedom and security for the Jewish people." Now, that I'm Jewish, and I have my reaction to that. What do you make of Vice President Biden and President Obama, who is planning a trip to Israel soon? Are they flexible on this, or are they once again marching lockstep with AIPAC like so many presidents and vice presidents? Is there some degree of hope with those guys?
Well, unfortunately, Bert, it seems as if President Obama and Vice President Biden are both towing the line of the AIPAC policies. I highly doubt that when President Obama visits Israel soon, that he will be visiting the West Bank, or let alone Gaza,
right,
and really seeing what it's like and where our U.S. tax dollars are going. And, you know, I understand that it's easy to argue the history of the creation of the State of Israel, but it's my understanding that at one point the Jewish population and the Arab population of the historical land of Palestine, at one point they did coexist.
Yes.
And so when people say, oh, this is a problem that's been going on for thousands of years and they've always hated each other, based on my experience speaking with people literally in Israel and the Palestinian territories, they've said that that's not the case at all. And at one point, there was peaceful coexistence, relatively peaceful coexistence. And so I don't think that a country that gives preference to one ethnicity or religion over another,
right,
needs to be a prerequisite for peace. I personally, and it's not my place to tell Israelis and Palestinians how to achieve a just solution, because it's up to them. But I'm personally an advocate for equal rights and democracy, and I don't think that you can have that in a country that's ultimately a theocracy.
A theocracy, yeah. We've seen theocracies, and when you think about religious states, you know, there's Iran. There's not a lot of them, and you know, it's not generally the same as a republic or a democracy where people are treated equally. If one religion prevails, and of course there's differences amongst the Jewish people and the Israeli people, you must, I would think, you know, with regard to the settlements and treatment of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, I would think that there is some degree of support from people, Jewish people within Israel itself, in terms of support for peace and justice with the Palestinians. What do you know of that?
Oh, most definitely. We, here at Code Pink, we've teamed up with an organization called the Women's Coalition for Peace, and it's a group of Israeli women who are advocates of ending the settlements, ending the occupation of Palestine. I'm not positive on where they stand in terms of a one-state, two-state solution, but that they definitely are a part of the boycott, sanction, divestment movement, and they're calling for a boycott from within. And we've worked with them on multiple issues, and most recently, we launched a campaign with them to connect people virtually between Israel and Iran, through kind of like a meme program, so people in Iran and people in Israel could send each other photos of their families with the caption, you know, "Iranians, we love you, we will never bomb your country," and vice versa, "Israelis, we love you, we will never bomb your country," with pictures of these families included on them. And it was a really great program, and it was something we modeled off of programs that other groups have been doing, and it was a wonderful success. And we've also worked with them on the boycott campaign that we run out of the Code Pink office in New York, which is called Stolen Beauty. It's a boycott of the Ahava cosmetics line,
mm-hmm,
which is made in an Israeli settlement in the West Bank. And the Women's Coalition for Peace has helped us push that, and they have helped with boycott actions in Israel. around that line. So we've done stuff, and there's other leftist groups in Israel that we haven't necessarily worked with. It's a very small segment of the population, but they're there nonetheless, and they need our solidarity. I encourage your listeners to check out the website whoprofits.org. It's run by an amazing woman named Dalit Baum, who is working on tracing who economically profits from the occupation of Palestine, and it's led to the information that she provides is used in a lot of the boycott campaigns because it's important to know who's making money off of this oppression, which is always the case when it comes to oppression because someone's profiting.
Yeah, sure. Let me just ask, we have just a couple minutes left. What can people do? How can people, how do you, Code Pink, et cetera, intend to keep the pressure up to make changes in the relationship between AIPAC and the U.S. Congress?
Well, one of the things just in general about the situation, about the occupation of Palestine that people can do is participate in the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanction. I encourage everyone to look up BDS online because it's not until the people of Israel really feel the pressure from the international community that they'll force their government to change its policies. And as we can see, AIPAC and the Israeli government are in cahoots and basically have the same, they share the same policies, which are not in the best interest of the American people. I encourage all of your listeners to call their representatives regularly and tell them that they don't want $3.1 billion sent to Israel every year. And there's a lot of great information about that at on the U.S. campaign's website. Check out anyoccupation.org. You can find out actually how much your community gives to Israel every year and every day in terms of military aid and what you know, it's always good to let your representatives know where that money could be going instead in terms of your community. So we need to be pressuring especially progressive Democrats to not pander to the AIPAC lobby and hold them accountable for what they're doing. And then, of course, you can always protest. If there's an AIPAC event happening in your community, which does happen, go out and protest. Put together a counter-conference so that not only are you protesting them, but you empower yourself with knowledge. Contact Code Pink. We can hook you up with speakers who are knowledgeable on this issue. And but most of all, I would really say that the most momentum is behind the BDS movement, and that's really how we're going to start making some changes in our policies and literally changes economically and academically on the ground until Israel has to comply with international law, and which will ultimately benefit everybody and every player in the region and the United States.
And BDS is Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, is that it?
That's correct.
BDS. Thank you so much. Very informative. Ali McCracken of Code Pink. We're talking about the power of AIPAC and the people of Palestine. Thanks so much for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show.
Thank you, Bert. Appreciate it.
First thing the occupation started, Palestine was left brokenhearted. Hands down, you won't believe the way they laid their wrath on her. 6 feet under is where they left us. So bad, the way that they were killing us. Too bad, we're not afraid to die when bombs fall from the sky.
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be a way.
How can we get back on track? Tell me how it's gonna be done. Will we win or lose this one?
Don't care about the fact,
cause they are in the lead. They say we all should be scared. Palestine will never be
there. Yeah.
Next thing,
they're taking all our houses.
Palestine,
right from all the corpses.
Tough luck.
They had to have the guns when all we have are rocks.
All day
they're killing little babies.
So we're
defending our families.
They said
that we were out of line. Who's wrong? Who's break this down?
we were gonna